NATO allies debate ways to boost military supplies for Ukraine following yet another overnight storm of Russian missile attacks.
This is one more reminder of the war's devastating consequences to innocent Ukraine civilians.
Russia may pull out of the Black Sea Grain Initiative, and Ukrainian crops are saturated in floodwaters from the collapsed Kharkovka Dam.
People are concerned about what this means for a lot of the investments that have been made in irrigation over the last 10, 15 years.
And later in the program, a campaign to save Ukrainian wine and wineries that have been almost destroyed in the war. Today is Thursday, May 15th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Lori London in Washington. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told defense ministers gathered in Brussels Thursday that Russia's unprovoked war in Ukraine demonstrates the need to stand with Kyiv and continue to provide support. He also addressed the recent launch of Ukraine's long-awaited counteroffensive.
The Ukrainians are making gains and Ukraine is able to liberate occupied land. This is due to the courage, the bravery, the skills of the Ukrainian soldiers, but it also highlights and demonstrates that the support NATO allies have been giving to Ukraine now for many, many months actually makes a difference on the battlefield as we speak.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin called on Kyiv's allies as well Thursday to dig deep to provide more arms and ammunition to fight Russia's invasion, particularly for air defenses. Addressing a meeting of defense ministers of the some 50 countries that give military aid to Ukraine, Austin underscored that Kyiv needs both short-term and long-term support.
And Ukraine's fight is a marathon and not a sprint. So we will continue to provide Ukraine with the urgent capabilities that it needs to meet this moment, as well as what it needs to keep itself secure for the long term from Russian aggression.
I caught up with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, who is in Brussels with Defense Secretary Austin. Carla, it sounds like there were significant updates on Thursday.
Well, we're learning more about the training of F-16s. And while everything was very hush-hush at the meeting with Secretary Austin and Chairman Milley and Jens Stoltenberg, we do know that the expectation is to start the training of Ukrainians on F-16s in the summer. The Netherlands announced that there would be a training facility for F-16 set up in an Eastern European nation, a NATO Eastern European nation specifically. There's also been discussions that Denmark will host some of the training as well. But what I am learning from U.S. officials is that this training will involve about two dozen Ukrainian pilots that will learn on fourth-generation aircraft, and that they will be starting this summer. If everything goes as planned, we will be starting to learn about how to fly these fourth-generation fighters this summer.
Any idea how long it would take for them to be up to speed to actually to use them in combat?
Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, he is the top U.S. military officer. He cautioned everybody that was at NATO today to remember and recognize that this is going to take a lot of time. This isn't just a matter of getting Ukrainians trained on a new piece of equipment. There is language training involved, because if you're going to fly an F-16, you have to be fluent in English, for example. Then there's the actual training. Then there's going to be the approvals of the transfers of F-16s or some other fourth generation fighter jet. So we will have to wait and see how this plays out in the coming days and weeks.
And of course, the major topic as well is the long-awaited and newly launched Ukraine counteroffensive. They're concerned about making sure Ukraine has what it needs.
Yes, and this, it should be noted, this was the first Ukraine defense contact group since the start of this counteroffensive. We've heard that Ukraine is making very slow gains, but they are still making some gains. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin told everybody today that this Ukraine war is a marathon, not a sprint, and that's why it's so important to keep up with the air defense munitions. That's why it's important to provide them vehicles when needed and spare parts. mainly what U.S. defense officials tell me is the goal is to not just provide them something when they run out of it, but to have these parts and these munitions and these weapons available for them, you know, before they need them. And that is something that Jens Stoltenberg talked about more today. He said that, in fact, NATO allies need to figure out a better way to ramp up their ammunition, not just for providing it to Ukraine, but also to replenish their own stockpiles.
VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reporting from Brussels. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Austin also noted there was another overnight Russian missile barrage in Ukraine.
The Russian barrage struck an apartment building and, according to reports, killed nearly a dozen people and injured many more. And recently, residents of this city have been forced to ration water after the destruction of the dam in Kherson last week. And this is one more reminder of the war's devastating consequences to innocent Ukraine civilians.
We hear more now from Anna Chernikova, reporting from Kyiv.
Air raid alarm was across the country again, starting from around 2 o'clock in the morning to 3 o'clock in the morning. So this is something that Ukrainians, unfortunately, are living through for the second month in a row right now. This time, the main victim, if we can put it this way, was again the city of Kryvyi Rih, similarly as a couple of days ago. We have confirmation from the Kryvyi Rih authorities that during the attack, a couple of missiles hit two industrial facilities in the city. We know that the rescue operation has already finished, and there are reports about quite significant destructions of the production facilities of these industrial areas. In general, Ukrainian air defense confirmed that this latest Russian attack involved 20 drones. All 20 drones were destroyed, and also attack involved 4 missiles, cruise missiles, and only one was destroyed. So the rest 3, unfortunately, hit the city of Kryvyi Rih, as we already discussed.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. The head of the United Nations nuclear watchdog has visited Europe's largest atomic power plant in southern Ukraine as the ongoing war brings heightened safety risks. Associated Press correspondent Karen Shamus reports.
Rafael Mariano Grossi, the International Atomic Energy Agency chief, had met in Kyiv with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky a few days earlier. His visit was to discuss concerns about the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. The IAEA has repeatedly expressed alarm about the facility, which faces a potential nuclear catastrophe amid a Russian takeover and constant battles nearby. The destruction of the Kakhovka Dam in southern Ukraine's partially Russian-occupied Kherson region has added a new concern. I'm Karen Chamas.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Laurie London. U.S. officials have growing concerns about the deepening ties between Russia and Iran, as well as the impact for the region. Craig Albert, professor of political science and graduate director of the Masters of Arts, Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University in Georgia, spoke with VOA's Steve Miller.
Since Russia invaded Ukraine well over a year ago, there have been all these international sanctions that have really put a hamper on what Russia can import. You mentioned possibly having these fabrication facilities inside the Russian Federation would allow it to continue to produce these drones if Ukraine were to somehow cut the supply. But given that the sanctions that are already in place, you know, what challenges do you see in terms of even Russia being able to manufacture these, given the limitations on trade with Russia after the war began?
Yeah, that's a great question. The U.S. has, let's not just consider Russia, but also Iran, right? Because the U.S. and U.S. corporations and worldwide corporations don't want to do anything that lands them on the hot seat with the U.S. for giving any type of sponsorship, material, or economics that goes against any of the U.S.'s sanctions against Iran or Russia. So it's a complicated matter with a manufacturing plant being in Russia. What companies are going to be a part of this, and not just the hardware for building these Iranian drones, but also the software needed to protect the plant from cyber attacks, for instance, which is something Russia's going to definitely need to invest in, because you can imagine that Ukraine's going to go right after that to try to shut it down. And NATO allies might assist Ukraine in doing that. So there's all types of second and third order effects of what companies are willing to invest in it. Is anybody willing to invest outside of Russia and Iran? And the only countries I can think of that might be able to or want to are the typical rogue states or states that are friendly to Russia. And I'm thinking here of North Korea, maybe Venezuela, China, which has been kind of ambiguous on its support of Russia for the war in Ukraine, but it might be able to provide the necessary material to go into Russia for this manufacturing plant, and other types of war material plants that might be on the horizon, thinking of hypersonic missile manufacturing. So we know that Iran just developed its own hypersonic missile, and it's not too far-fetched to think that they want to build those in Russia to supplement Russia's hypersonic capabilities as well. So any type of company that partakes in this is liable to be sanctioned by the United States and NATO, if not EU itself as well. So that's something that has to be considered. So it's going to be complicated to see how likely it is that it's going to work out. But I would guess, based on the satellite images that have been, you know, publicly released, that the plant is pretty much ready to go. They're just finishing the industrial line capacity on the inside, which means, I assume, that most of the material is already there, or Russia can process this itself, and Iran just gave them the blueprints for the plant and how to make the drones. So I think everything is probably in place for them to go live with that and be able to produce up to 6,000 drones per year.
You know, you mentioned that the facility is perhaps almost ready to go online and produce this large number of drones per year, which Russia really has been using to, you know, carry out a number of airstrikes within Ukraine, especially in recent months. But there also have been some reports of attacks either by pro-Ukrainian forces in Russia carrying out attacks on Russian soil, and allegations that Ukrainian forces have carried out attacks within the Russian Federation, not using U.S. equipment, but other equipment that they have. When these plants go online and start producing material that Russia may use against Ukraine, what kind of security concerns does that bring up for the Russian Federation now that they have a new plant online that apparently appears to be producing weapons specifically to target Ukrainians in Ukraine?
Yeah, another great question. That's why Russia is building this particular plant in the far east of Russia. So it's far away from any potential Ukrainian saboteurs. Of course, you do have to worry about the Russian militias who are anti-Putin, but that movement is less of a worry in the far east of Russia than it is the closer you get to the European landmass itself. So I think that's probably what went into the calculation of moving that plant or creating that plant in the far east.
Craig Albert, professor of political science at Augusta University in Georgia, speaking with VOA's Steve Miller. The Kremlin said this week that it's considering withdrawing from the Black Sea grain deal, alleging the West has cheated Moscow by not implementing any of the promises it had made to ensure Russian agricultural goods reached world markets. The agreement allowing Ukraine to resume seaborne grain exports was brokered by the United Nations and Turkey last July to help tackle a global food crisis that has been exacerbated by Russia's war in Ukraine. I recently spoke with Joseph Glauber, senior fellow with the International Food Policy Research Institute, and asked if it's too soon to assess the agricultural damages resulting from the Kakhovka Dam collapse.
First of all, you have to understand that a lot of the area along the river has been in a war zone. And so there's a lot less production there this year than there would be in a normal year. We know that from satellite imagery that we use to track production. And it certainly seems that the production is a lot more sparse in those areas near the battle zone. That makes sense. That's not to say that some land probably was adversely affected, but it's not going to be much in terms of the overall production. People are concerned about what this means for a lot of the investments that have been made in irrigation over the last 10, 15 years. But I think the biggest concern right now is just the escalation of tension and what this might mean for the Black Sea Grain Initiative, which has really been the lifeline for Ukraine farmers to get their product to the market. And it's been a lifeline for the rest of the world to get Ukraine products into other markets. So Russia terminated the agreement. They have threatened to do so many times. That's the biggest concern I have from all of this. And I think that's what the market is watching most closely right now.
But I'm hearing that the lack of water supply to the land could endanger the production of like 4 million tons of grains and crops that are exported, and that, you know, right now it's saturated with polluted water?
That's not this year. What they're really talking about is if those irrigation, right now there's just not that much production because of the war itself. Now, it will be important if we return to a more normal situation. All the irrigation ditches and all that would have to be rebuilt, have to reconstruct the dam. All of that will be important because irrigation has certainly been important in that area. That's been one of the things, the investments that have helped make Ukraine such a large exporter over the last 10 or 15 years. But right now, it's not a current problem. That's just because of the war.
The situation, obviously, with the Black Sea grain deal on and off, the war has already had a huge impact on Ukraine's grain exports, which feed the world.
That's right. And it because of the added costs of shipping out through the West into Eastern Europe, or even with the Black Sea Grain Initiative, there are additional costs. All that has been costs that have been absorbed by Ukraine farmers. And as a consequence, and on top of that, the war itself, production is about 40% less than what it was in 2019. So we've already seen this big decline in Ukraine production because of the war.
So we've got the impacts of the war itself. And then, of course, the future is uncertain given the degradation of the land. And then there is the big picture issue of global food security. That is already an issue, and the whole situation in Ukraine is making it worse. How concerned are you about that?
I think we were, in one sense, we were lucky last year. Prices spiked in the early part of the year, but by the end of the summer, they were back to pre-war levels. That's largely because we had very good crops in a lot of major wheat producing areas, particularly Russia, particularly Europe. And because global stock levels have been at very tight levels over the last 2 years, we haven't really been able to rebuild those stocks. And because of that, we just have a lot less cushion if there is a major drought somewhere. So it's very much of a concern, because Ukraine normally would be supplying, you know, 10% of the world wheat exports, and they're not able to do so. And so that has to be made up from other areas. And so people are looking around the world and watching weather very, very closely. Flood damage is always one of the toughest things, frankly. This is different because it's a rupturing of a dam, you know, and so these irrigation things, I think until we get a better assessment, it's just very, very difficult to say with any certainty what it's going to mean. At the same time, the dam was damaged. We've also had damage to the ammonia pipeline that runs from Russia to the ports around Odessa. And that's been a big sticking point for Russia in their agreement to reauthorize the Black Sea Grain Initiative. They have wanted Ukraine to reopen that pipeline, and right now is damaged. Ukraine's position has all along has been that's not part of the deal, but it's just to say that's another friction point on this whole renegotiation of the Black Sea Grain Initiative.
Joseph Glauber, senior fellow with the International Food Policy Research Institute. Meanwhile, a delegation of African leaders is set to visit both Ukraine and Russia this weekend in a push to end Russia's 16-month-long war, and also stress the importance of the grain deal they say is needed to tackle food insecurity on the continent. Australia is blocking Russia's plans to build a new embassy near the Australian federal parliament, citing unspecified national security concerns. There's been no response so far from Russia's diplomatic staff. Australia has imposed broad sanctions on Russia and sent military and humanitarian aid to Ukraine. It's Russia's invasion of its neighbor. From Phil Mercer reports.
Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said Thursday that a new Russian embassy so close to Parliament House would pose a threat to national security. His government has proposed emergency legislation that would terminate the Russian Federation's lease on the land. The move doesn't affect Russia's existing embassy in suburban Canberra, which is about a 10-minute drive to Australia's federal parliament. Albanese said that presence would continue, just as Australia has a diplomatic presence in Moscow. The Australian leader hasn't specified what sort of security threat. A proposed new Russian embassy, less than 2 kilometres from Parliament House, would pose. But he told reporters in Canberra the risk was too great.
The government has received very clear security advice as to the risk presented by a new Russian presence so close to Parliament House. We're acting quickly to ensure the lease site does not become a formal diplomatic presence. The government condemns Russia's illegal and immoral invasion of Ukraine. To be clear, today's decision is one taken in the national security interests of Australia.
Media reports earlier this year said that Australian intelligence agencies had uncovered a so-called hive of Russian spies posing as diplomats. At the time, security chiefs said that Australia was facing an unprecedented spy threat, but didn't name the country or countries involved. Albanese has rejected suggestions that Australia wasn't doing enough to support Kyiv's war efforts. Australia is among the largest non-NATO contributors to Ukraine, supplying missiles and armoured personnel carriers. Since the February 2022 invasion began, Canberra has imposed sanctions on hundreds of Russian politicians, including President Vladimir Putin, military commanders and business people. They are the most sweeping penalties Australia has ever put on another country. Canberra has also banned the import of Russian oil, petroleum, coal and gas. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
U.S. wine expert Gail Corrigan has launched a campaign to save Ukrainian wine and wineries that have been almost destroyed in the war. To raise money and show off the product, she brought some rare Ukrainian wines to the U.S. Irina Solomko has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Is a U.S. entrepreneur and wine lover. In 2019, she co-founded a company called Sipiravi USA and started importing wine from the country of Georgia to America. And then, in 2020, she tried Ukrainian wine for the first time.
And it was kind of love at first sip. It was delicious.
She expanded her business to import Ukrainian wine to the U.S. as well, just before Russia's invasion. Corrigan decided she would use this wine for charity purposes only.
We're using it to raise awareness and also to raise funds that will go back into the Ukrainian wine industry.
Art Winery is located in the Bakhmut region, where some of the harshest fighting of the war has taken place. The company has been creating sparkling wine for hundreds of years, some of which has become quite rare during wartime. Alexandra Chernichenko, marketing director of Art Winery, says production at the Bakhmut factory stopped when Russia invaded. However, the company managed to move its staff and all its stock to safer areas of Ukraine days after the war started.
Everything above ground was destroyed. It's tough for us to assess the losses because most production lines were below ground, some 72 meters deep underground. And right now, we have no access there.
She says the company is preparing to ship a large batch of wine they managed to save to Corrigan in the U.S.
Gail is our favorite partner. We love working with her and we are very grateful for her help.
For each charity event, Corrigan picks a Ukrainian organization in the U.S. Many of those chosen then organize their own fundraising events with the wine Corrigan gives them.
We had one bottle in an event that happened here in Rhode Island that was auctioned off for $2,000.
Corrigan says she sends all the funds she raises back to Ukrainian vineyards so they can revive their work after the war ends. In the meantime, although all wine production in the Bakhmut region has been put on hold, Art Winery has moved some of its production to safer areas of Ukraine. For Irina Salomka in Rhode Island, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage of Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Lori London.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.